A lot can happen in the first 100 days of a new president's administration, and that leads us to ask, what is likely to happen to our farm animals in the first 100 days of the Biden administration?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1261st edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Lisbon who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, it's out with the old and in with the new as a new administration takes charge in Washington, D.C. During the first 100 days of this new administration, the dumpster out back of the White House is likely to get filled up with lots of the old administration's policies to be replaced with shiny new ones. As chroniclers of what's eating what up and down the food chain, we are particularly interested in policies relating to food and agriculture. The old administration's food and agriculture policies were pretty much focused on turning on the engines of industry and then getting the heck out of the way. The new administration's policies look to be significantly different. Case in point, whereas the old administration allowed slaughterhouses to speed up their production lines to get more from less, perhaps, the new administration has just announced that it has slowed down the lines in the interest of animal welfare. In fact, the Humane Society of the United States has presented the new administration with a wish list of measures it would like to see taken to throw out the old administration's way of doing things. And that leads us to ask, what will the new administration do to enhance the welfare of farm animals? Who better to ask than Josh Balk, who is the Vice President of Farm Animal Protection, Humane Society of the United States. Josh, welcome to the food chain.
It's an honor to be on your 1261st episode, Michael.
There you go. Quite a while there of talking about food, don't you think? And you know, the funny thing is, I don't think I've ever done the same show twice in all of that time, because there's always something new and exciting. And of course, what's new and exciting right now is a new administration in Washington, D.C. And you folks at the Humane Society are already banging on the door over there, are you not?
We are. We are throwing out our requests, asking for meetings and discussions and strategy sessions. And I got to say, I feel pretty hopeful. I really do. I feel like we can move forward when it comes to improving the lives of farm animals. And I'm cautiously optimistic. We have good partnerships in the administration and in Congress to have it happen.
Okay, so let's start off a little bit about the Humane Society of the United States. Tell us a little bit about this really big organization.
And we are big, you're right. We try to take on the issues that smaller organizations simply just don't have the size to take on, perhaps the expertise to take on, the bandwidth to take on. And that's why we take on within animal farming the big issues of the day. And our focus is trying to shift our nation towards more humane, sustainable farming. And that is on a broad scale. We do work on the federal level, in the state level. We work with the largest food corporations in the United States on enacting their animal welfare policies. And this holistic approach of working in the state and federal legislatures while simultaneously working with the largest food corporations in the nation allows us to transform how literally billions of animals will be raised and killed in our nation. We're very proud of our success. At the same time, the best is yet to come.
Okay, good. Now, as I listened to you, something popped into my mind. And I wonder, what mean you by the word humane?
Certainly, most people listening in to your show right now feel that animals ought to be treated humanely. Most people don't want animals to be treated with cruelty, abuse. They don't want animals to suffer. And I think that's just a great common ground that we as people have. And so that's a good starting place. At the same time, the way animals are raised within these confinement systems in the United States, it often doesn't reflect those values that we all share. You know, when we look at animals being raised in tiny cages, whether it's egg-laying chickens, mother pigs, baby veal calves, whether it's the way chickens are slaughtered, it simply does not comport with the basic belief I think we all have that animals ought to be treated with some basic decency. They should be able to be engaged in abilities to fulfill their natural requirements to have a life that's frankly worth living. Mm-hmm. And also, when they're killed, they should be done in a way that doesn't involve immense amount of suffering and pain. So those themes that we have core to our belief, we feel aren't being reflected in the way that most animals are being raised in food production.
Okay. But back to the word humanely. Does that relate to human-like?
Well, you know, humane, when one looks at the definition of humane, it means to be treated in a way that's compassionate, that demonstrates mercy, kindness. And I think when it comes to human, it more has to do with we have a human responsibility to treat others with the type of mercy and compassion, especially those who are at our mercy, like farm animals. And so, you know, what's humane to chickens is different than for us, Michael. I mean, I don't have any interest to lay eggs in a nesting area. Yeah. I don't have any interest at all to perch or dust bathe or scratch, but chickens do. And allowing these animals to engage in their basic behaviors, that's a way to show humane treatment for these animals.
You know, I think the Bible had a great way of putting that. It instructed us that we should take dominion of the animals.
Dominion, that's right.
And dominion is a way of saying taking responsibility of.
That's exactly right. And I think what you're saying resonates with me a lot. You know, having the basic decency and responsibility to treat animals, who we can treat in almost any way that we want, but treating them, allowing them to actually have a life where they can do things like walking and turning around, like that seems to me it's basic decency. You know, that kind of reflects the at least bare minimum dominion that we should have over our fellow creatures. And, you know, the fact that they don't have, you know, the type of protections that maybe they should, I think that reflects our character in terms of how we treat them. Because the more that we treat them at a higher level, the more it, I think, reflects our character that we're the type of people to show that mercy to those who simply don't have any power themselves.
Okay, and then, you know, I note that there are humane societies everywhere. If you do a search on humane society, up pops a million humane societies. Is the Humane Society of the United States kind of like an umbrella organization for all of these baby humane societies?
You know, those local organizations, they are separate. They are often local humane societies, local SPCAs, local shelters. And most of what they do has to do with rescuing dogs and cats and finding new homes for them. And we honor and cherish the work that they're doing. At the same time, those aren't the type of organizations that can work on real big national issues, like changing our food system. And that's where we come into play.
They don't hang around in Washington, D.C., where the real deal happens, right?
There are a couple of shelters in D.C., but you're exactly right. Your point is well taken. They support the type of work that's happening, but they simply don't have the ways to go about it on a national scale.
Okay, now, Josh Back. How did Josh Back become a jihadist for farm animals?
Well, you know, I grew up just like anybody who just cares about animals. So I don't feel like I'm actually that different than anybody. You know, when I grew up, I had dogs, just like so many of your listeners.
Were you a city boy?
More suburbs. Okay. More suburbs. I grew up in the suburbs in Pennsylvania. And you know what? I just love my dogs like most people love their dogs. I don't feel like I love them any more than anybody else loves their dogs. And growing up, my dad took me to local farms, and I got to pet cows and feed horses carrots and throw some feed out to the chickens and you know, just to enjoy being around these animals like anybody. And so when you ask me, you know, how, you know, I came to be the where I'm at, like, I actually don't feel like I'm that different than anybody. Mm-hmm. I just happen to want to, you know, work at an organization that can, you know, create the type of world that I think most of us want. I mean, don't most of us want a world where they're all farm animals have a life worth living? I mean, don't we all want to live in a world where animals, you know, aren't suffering, or at least try to pave a way where they're suffering less? I mean, don't we want a world where, you know, responsible farmers are thriving in a way that animals aren't treated as if they're mere commodities? I mean, I just feel like, you know, the world I'm trying to create is a world most of us probably want. And we just have to work together to get there.
Good. How do you go about, how does a humane society of the United States go about affecting government policy with respect to farm animals? I suspect there's part of that is lobbying. Part of it is advocating. Part of it is fundraising.
Well, most of it when it comes to farm animals at this point in time is at the state level. And we've had two specific strategies. One has to do with waging ballot measures. And for those listeners who aren't in a state that allow ballot measures, what a ballot measure is that about half the states allow it. You get government petitions. If you collect enough, you can put a question on the ballot. So when people vote for president or senator or governor, they can also vote on a question we put forward. And the questions that we put forward in states like Florida, California, in Massachusetts, Arizona, has to do with banning the confinement of farm animals in cages. And you know what? We've won every time. Every single time we've won. We've won in blue states, red states, purple states. And why is it? It's because farm animals happens to be an area that we can bring people across all political spectrums to support. And when it comes to farm animals, the better treatment of them. So we've waged these ballot measure campaigns. Simultaneously, we also work to pass bills that are introduced via the typical ways through state legislatures. And then we form, you know, coalitions in the states. You know, we lobby in the states, and hopefully we can bring together enough legislators to vote yes so we can pass these laws. And so I got to tell you, it's been a massive success over the past couple years. We've passed more laws for farm animals than any time in U.S. history. So we have a lot of momentum on our side, and we're bringing Democrats, Republicans, Independents together to move forward for better treatment of animals and passing these type of laws that reflect that value.
Good. Well, we're going to take a quick break here in a very short amount of time. But when we come back, I'd like to ask you about the bill of particulars you're taking to the federal government and saying, this is what we'd like to do, like to have you folks work on here. And there's some pretty amazing things that you're working on. And I suspect that when it gets right down to it, selling mostly a lot of city people on the notion of taking good care of farm animals isn't really that much of a difficult job, because, as you say, we all want to treat animals fairly. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host, with Josh Back, Vice President, Farm Animal Protection, Humane Society of the United States, right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, there is a new sheriff in Washington, D.C., and he's changing the way we do things. And one of the ways that the Humane Society of the United States would like to see him change is how we go about treating our farm animals. Is there a way we can be more humane in the way we treat our farm animals? So let's go to Josh Back and ask him, what was the big difference between the Trump administration and the Biden administration with respect to farm animals?
Well, it's been a few days, so we will find out more in the weeks, months, and years to come. But in the first few days, we've already seen a difference. And that has to do with slowing the line speeds down in chicken slaughterhouses. Mm-hmm. So as folks may know, most chickens in this country are killed in slaughterhouses where they are shackled fully conscious by workers, and they have their necks slit. Then they go into a scalding tank where their feathers are removed. And not only is that inherently a cruel process, oftentimes these animals miss the neck slicer completely, and they go into the feather removal tank fully conscious, so they're scalded to death. And that happens, according to the USDA, about a 500,000 animals per year. I mean, it's horrendous. It's a nightmare way to end an animal's life. So it's already a bad process. It's already cruel and inhumane. You know what? It's also bad for workers because it's nonstop shackling animals second after second after second. And what the Trump administration did was to allow large poultry producers to speed up the line even more to make it worse for animals, worse for workers, and it's something that both worker advocacy groups and animal advocacy groups have spoken out against.
Okay.
And so in the first few days of the Biden administration, they reversed the allowance of the Trump administration of speeding up the line speed. So instead of 175 chickens killed per minute, now it's back to 140 birds per minute. Is it already too fast? Yeah, of course it's too fast. But at least it's not about 2.3 birds per second. Can you imagine that? These workers trying to kill 2.3 birds per second. You can imagine the type of severe problems that come with it. So to answer your question, already in the first couple of days, there's been a positive step forward.
Okay. And to what extent will this slowing down of the line speed improve the animal welfare of chickens? Having been, a farm boy and having butchered more than a few chickens myself, I don't think any process is actually very humane when it gets right down to it. But that's what you do if you want to eat chicken. So how much does slowing down the line speed really improve the welfare of chickens?
When it comes to chickens when they're shackled, it is such a fast process that they are often shackled, quote unquote, incorrectly. The chickens are shackled with one leg, perhaps at a time, or they're shackled so fast that they're not fully shackled and they fall off, and they fall off even before the rest of the process occurs, so that they're reshackled and reshackled. There are numerous ways that a speeding shackle in front of a worker causes problems because of a lack of smoothness that could occur in a slower method. When animals are shackled improperly, that's when they miss the slicing blade completely and go into the scalding tank fully conscious. That's when they're sliced incorrectly. So instead of their neck slicing, it could be their wings that are sliced or their chest being sliced. Mm-hmm. So they're not even killed at that moment.
So the line's moving so fast that the man with the knife or the woman with the knife hits the wrong part, and there you go.
A man or woman with a knife after the neck slicing blade, that's mechanical, which often is worse because the machine can't tell if a bird is shackled properly or not. It just keeps on going.
Right.
And so the faster and faster the process, the more these animals are incorrectly shackled to go into a machine slicer that can't tell whether the animal's or in any position to have their next slice in the way that kills them as quickly as possible. So that's a major problem when it comes to animal welfare. Also, just speed requires workers to grab the animals as fast as possible. And when you're trying to deal with just speed, it's almost like, you know, the old I Love Lucy famous episode where she's trying to kind of box up those chocolates as soon as possible. Perhaps
there's another good
iconic
one.
Moment.
There's another good one of those with Charlie Chaplin in Modern Times.
You go, Charlie Chaplin too. Mm-hmm.
So
exactly.
Once you're on the line, it's the line. Yeah, exactly. Well,
that's
okay.
Right.
Let's move on to the next thing that you're working on, which kind of surprised me, which was strengthen housing, husbandry, and management standards for organic wealth for animal welfare on organic farms.
You know, the Obama administration implemented a rule that created in the first ever federal guidelines for how farm animals are treated on the farm. There were none beforehand federally. And the Obama administration ensured minimum standards, not saying it's utopian or even idyllic, but at least it's minimum standard for organic production. And the major reason why is that when consumers think of organic, they also think about how animals are treated. And so in the Obama administration ensured that animals had outdoor access, they had more space, they had enrichment, basic bottom standards for organic production.
Was that the same thing as the proposition here in California? Proposition, I forgot what the number was, but
12?
It's a
bit different. No, good memory with Prop 12 that was passed in 2018, a campaign I led a few years ago. Prop 12 isn't just for organic operators. It has to do with any operator who is raising chickens and egg production, pigs in pork production, and calves in veal production.
Okay, so that's everybody then.
Prop 12 in California is broader. Yep, you got it. It's broader. The federal guidelines from the Obama administration just was specifically for organic operations. Now, the Trump administration withdrew the rule regarding organic operations and removed these type of guidelines. What we're asking the Biden administration to do is simply go back to the Obama administration's rule. It was widely supported by consumer organizations, family farm organizations, and there were, frankly, it was lauded nationally. Now we just hope to go back to what was done just a short time ago, just one administration ago, and we feel it's very reasonable for the Biden administration to simply go back to the Obama rule in place. Related to the treatment of animals in organic operations.
And that is another element in your wish list here, is to end direct and indirect federal support for legal challenges to Proposition 12, California's ballot initiatives governing cage sizes. So what you want the government to do is to stop the support for legal challenges to these kinds of efforts to restrict cage sizes.
You nailed it. So Prop 12, which you cited earlier, it passed in a ballot measure 2018 with nearly two-thirds of the vote, a political landslide, and ensured that egg-laying hens, mother pigs, baby veal calves aren't confined in small cages, and ensured that the eggs, pork, and veal sold in the state come from cage-free animals. And so it is a dramatic step forward for better treatment of animals. And since then, we've passed similar laws in Oregon, Washington, Michigan, Colorado. There have been lawsuits filed by some within big animal agribusiness to try to overturn California's Proposition 12. The Trump administration has joined one of those lawsuits to overturn Prop 12. That's through the Department of Justice, through the USDA. Now that the Biden administration is in place, we're asking them to withdraw its support for opposing and trying to overturn these farm animal laws. We feel it's very reasonable. In fact, Vice President Kamala Harris actually defended very similar laws in the past when she was the Attorney General in California. So we are cautiously optimistic they are going to withdraw their support. And frankly, it's the right thing to do. Farm animals should be able to stand up, lie down, turn around, extend their limbs. They shouldn't be in cages. And you know what? When states vote to ensure this very basic law, we shouldn't have the Department of Justice or USDA trying to overturn it. And we feel the Biden administration will do the right thing.
Well, I'd like to back up, if I might, to the organic farms effort to restrict the way organic farms can treat their animals. I know a lot of farmers who see themselves as organic or even beyond organic, who treat their cows and their chickens and their ducks in the way that my grandfather did, which, you know, when you'll still have to chop their heads off, so it's not really humane, but they lived a good life, those critters did.
Yeah.
Now, and when I hear somebody that's trying to further restrict organic farming, last week I did a radio show with a fellow who pointed out that 80% of America's organic food by volume now comes from someplace else because it's easier to grow someplace else. And who knows what happens someplace else. And I'm wondering about the, as we turn the screws down on organic farming here, what's going to happen to our organic farms, those who grow animals for us? Will they be able to compete with foreign producers? You know, we've gotten rid of the mandatory country of origin labeling laws, so you don't know where your meat comes from anymore. Organic meat, organic chickens could come from Tierra del Fuego, and we wouldn't know. So as we make it harder and harder and harder for organic farmers and all farmers, does that not push farmers and farming and agriculture offshore to where conditions could be much less humane than they are here?
Right. I think it, fortunately, I think it literally does the opposite. Sounds like the animals who were raised by your grandfather lived a great life and maybe had one bad day at the end. And I hope every animal has a great life and maybe has a bad moment at the end, and that's it. And you know, that's the type of, you know, responsible farming, certainly, that we encourage. Now, the reason why organic farmers are our allies in this is the following. The rules that are in place that we're encouraging are followed by family farmers across the nation. It's the big agribusiness corporations that lobbied the Trump administration to revoke them so big agribusiness could start using their practices and then label themselves as organic. So if you are a family farmer anywhere in the country, whether it's Kansas, California, Nebraska, wherever, and you're raising animals in the typical organic fashion, you know, outside, you know, basic behaviors being met, the last thing that you want is to have to compete with big agribusiness industrial operations selling their product as organic, undercutting your operations when you're doing it right, and then you're the one who's going out of business. The family farmers here in our country, they've been more afraid of big agribusiness in the United States versus those overseas. Well, and so this is allowing small family farmers to have a chance in their country rather than being undercut by larger operators.
Yeah, and I guess the only way to really make that work is if the local farmers, the organic farmers, can have the opportunity to sell locally. And key to that would be to having local processing facilities, as opposed to the way we have it set up now, where there are really just four big beef companies or meat companies that control almost everything. And so that's a puzzle to me. You know, we establish all of these rules and regulations designed to make things better, but in the end, we end up buying chicken from China that says organic, and you don't know where it's from. And if you go down to the big box store, that's probably what you're going to get. So the only way around that is to, you know, look the farmer in the eye and say, "Dear farmer, what's in your food?"
You know, I think it's a good point that when people go to the local farmer's market, as an example, and you can look your farmer in the eye. And I've been to many farmer's markets, across the country. I don't know any farmers there who are raising their animals organically, who are confining their chickens in sheds by the hundreds of thousands. That just seems such an oddity to even consider. That's how organic operators, would run their system, here in the country. Without this in place, organic egg farmers who have maybe several hundred or maybe several thousand, of their hens, running around outside, having a good life. If we don't have this in place, do you know what their competition is going to be? It's going to be a large-scale egg corporation that has millions of animals indoors. And yes, the birds might be given organic feed, but in terms of the treatment of the animals, it is dramatically less than a small family farmer. And then those industrial operators are going to be able to label their eggs as organic in the grocery store right next to that small family farmer. And guess what? They're going to sell it for less. And who's going to lose out?
And that's the small family farmer. That is the way it is.
It doesn't have to. We can fix it.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll pick up the other items on your agenda for the United States government. Folks, this is Michael Olt, the Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What with Josh Back, Vice President, Farm Animal Protection, Humane Society of the United States. Do stay tuned.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. Metro Farm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning Metro Farm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to knoxgardenbox.com. That's K-N-O-X, gardenbox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
History buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place while the USS Dale steamed through the Bering Sea, January 1943.
We took some terrible waves up there. One time a big groundswell rolled us over so far I thought we'd never make it back. I was on the lee deck when the ship went over into that roll. Luckily, I was able to grab onto a bulkhead handrail, and when the Dale went over, my feet left the deck. I hung there with nothing between my feet and the ocean but air. I was scared. She went over on her beam, paused for a minute, then she shuddered and shook because one of her propellers was out of the water and thrashing air. Slowly, very slowly, she rolled back toward the vertical, and my feet found the deck again. That wave scared the devil out of me.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, it is a puzzle. How can we treat our farm animals more humanely? Their job is to provide us with meat, and our job is to take dominion over them, which means that we have the responsibility to, as we're growing them up for our food, to treat them as best we can. We have that responsibility, and nobody else does. It's our job. So how do we go about doing it? Well, the Humane Society of the United States has a list of particulars that it's taking to the new administration in Washington, D.C., and saying, we'd like you to do the following. We'd like you to slow down the line speeds at slaughterhouses. We'd like you to end direct and indirect federal support for legal challenges to the propositions that we put forth to make it more humane for animals. And we have a whole list of things like that. We want you to strengthen housing, husbandry, and management standards for animal welfare on organic farms. And Josh, you put up a pretty good argument there on that one. And let's see what else you have to put on the table here. Implement changes to prevent fishing gear entanglement and vessel strikes. Now, here out here in California coast, we just had a huge delay in our crab season. We're accustomed to having our crab for Thanksgiving and the Christmas holidays, but not this year. Why? Because the whales were migrating through, and we didn't want them to get caught in the crab nests. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, there are numerous things that we can do related to reducing the number of animals who are caught, and they're known as bycatch. You know, bycatch has to do with the killing of animals who are not targeted by the fishermen. You know, I think, you know, one of the first areas we used to think about this had to do with dolphins who were killed in the tuna nets. That kind of like brought to the surface to so many of us, you know, what happens, you know, when it comes down to fishing. And so what we're trying to do is continue down that path by having more of a thoughtful approach when it comes to oceanic fishing, reducing the amount of bycatch. Yes, you're right. We don't want whales caught in nets. We don't want turtles caught in nets and seals and sea lions and birds. And you know what? Consumers don't either. Like, I don't know any consumer out there who is out there and buying any fish and thinking, gosh, you know, like, I really hope some whales got caught up in these nets. And so I think it comes down to, like, you know, the basic theme of the conversation we're having, Michael, is it's like, in my mind, it's a like very basic common sense stuff that most people, whether you shop at Walmart or Whole Foods or a farmer's market, we can all sit around and agree on. And it's all about implementing that change so it actually occurs on the ground or in the ocean in this case. And it is reflective of what we as an American society believe animals, you know, ought to be treated.
Now, we can certainly do that with the incoming administration, as you are doing as we speak. But can we do it with others, other countries? And if we can't do it with other countries, won't our fishermen go to some other country and catch their fish and then bring it here?
Well, there are a couple of points on this. One is that I'm proud to be an American where we're leaders. And I don't wait to the lowest of the low countries do something before we do something. And when it comes to animals, you know what? I mean, let's just start with dogs. I mean, we banned dog fighting. There are places around the world that hasn't. Should we not ban dog fighting because there are other places around the world that hasn't banned it? Other places around the world don't have laws related to cruelty to our pets at home. Should we not have those type of laws because we're going to wait for every other country to do it?
But that does not address the issue of other countries taking the fish and putting it into a can and sending it here with the words line caught or something like that, wild caught.
Yeah, I think it, right. I think it, Michael, I think what it does, it addresses the issue that we should be leaders morally. And yes, you know, we should have a consideration when it comes to shifting a global economic framework around a certain business model. So when it comes to, let's say, cage-free, then this leads into your point about, hey, is this going to just drive things overseas or something like that? You know, when it comes to an issue like cage-free, we are leaders now in the world in shifting the egg industry to cage-free. And all these fears, you know, we were told before, like, oh my gosh, all these eggs are going to be imported by countries that don't have any rules related to the treatment of egg-laying hens. But that none of that has happened. You know, what's happened is, like, in the egg industry, and same thing what can happen in the fishing industry, is that we've led the way here. The egg industry in the United States is shifting to cage-free. We're about 30% cage-free now. And if I was on your show maybe a couple of years ago, you and I would be talking about how it's low single digits. Yeah, the egg industry has adapted. It's thriving. And you know what? Around the world, the other egg sectors are now switching to cage-free too. And so I see this happening in fishing. I see this happening in egg production. And most of the other issues that you and I could probably talk about, America can be the lead. And then we can work to get other countries to follow that lead if they haven't been there already.
Somebody has to take leadership, and it would help if they had a good moral compass about them, especially when
right.
It comes to taking dominion of our animals and whatnot. Well, you have other things that you're really going for that are very interesting, which let's start with CAFOs, which I think stands for Confined Animal Feeding Operation. Am I right?
Concentrated animal feeding operations.
Concentrated, confined.
Still makes the same point. I don't be nitpicky on that one, Michael. It makes the same exact point. Absolutely.
So, you know, when I look at confined or concentrated animal feeding operations, I sometimes think that we're treating animals like we treat ourselves. Because if you look at us, it seems like we're the ones who are living in a concentrated animal feedlot operation when we confine ourselves to little tiny boxes in cities and sit there in these little tiny boxes and somebody brings food to us from Uber or whatnot. It's not too different if you think about it. So is that not what we're doing to our animals, the same thing we're doing to ourselves? Or am I really off base there?
I wouldn't ever be so presumptuous to ever tell you you're off base, Michael. And I'm with you. And, you know, in this COVID world, I think we all have to get out a bit more and put our mask on and then maybe go to a park and enjoy some outdoors a little bit. I will say there is a bit of a difference between being kind of stuck in an apartment, which is certainly not ideal, versus being a mother pig confined in a cage where you can't turn around your whole life. These are what are called as gestation crates, where mother pigs are confined. These crates are barely larger than their bodies. They're basically living in their own coffins for about 4 years. So I guess the apt comparison would be is that if we laid down in a coffin and we weren't able to ever be removed from that coffin ever, our whole life. So that is the life of these mother pigs. Yeah. In these concentrated feeding operations. And for egg-laying hens, Michael, you might appreciate this comparison. We'll bring it back to apartment complexes. You know, I live in apartments like most of us perhaps in our life have. You know, I've been stuck in elevators before. And, you know, being in an elevator with eight other people, I mean, that's not a fun experience. And
certainly,
you know, I was in it
not.
For a few minutes. Oh. It's not a fun experience, no way. And imagine being an egg-laying chicken in a barren wire cage where you're stuck with eight other chickens in a cage the size of your home microwave. I think that's kind of the comparison there. And while we can finally get out of that elevator in our apartment complex, these chickens are there for a year and a half. And that's the type of treatment we're trying to eliminate when we are passing these laws and working on these corporate policies to go cage-free.
Mm-hmm. And you folks are doing a wonderful job of going after them. But when it comes right down to it, isn't it our responsibility as consumers to do the heavy lifting by taking our money and buying the kinds of meat that best reflects our moralities as well? Shouldn't that be our job out here? Is to go to the store and say, this is how I want my animals treated. And I'll buy I'll buy it if you sell it, and if you don't want to do that, I won't buy it.
You know, I think we all have a role to play. We all certainly do. And I do want to give consumers a bit of a break on this, though. You know, go back to eggs as an example. if someone goes into any grocery store in the United States, there's going to be egg cartons that say something like Michael's Family Farm or Josh's Family Farm on it. And a happy photo of a chicken and maybe a farmer with his kids on the cart. And if it was someone like my brother or my mom going in there who are good people, they're not experts like you, Michael, or perhaps have the knowledge I have. They just think, oh, well, this must come from a happy, good farm where animals are treated well. They'll buy that carton. But you know what? There are no laws in this country at all that says cartons like that, if those contain eggs from caged chickens, actually have to label them eggs from caged chickens. So even good-hearted people, people like my brother or my mom or people who you may know,
probably most everybody, when it gets right down to it.
I think you're right.
Because yeah. As city people, we have lost pretty much all connection with our food. And we don't know. We know what we're told on television or radio or newspapers or what we see on the labels, but we have no idea. We can't see, and we have no way of seeing beyond what we're told. And so we're kind of in a fix unless we go about educating ourselves. And I think there's a lot of that happening right now.
Well, you know what? First of all, I think you're exactly right, is that, you know, so many folks are simply just not aware of what's going on to most farm animals. And I think you're also right that, you know, I think we all can be more educated on that, myself included, frankly. At the same time, I firmly believe there has to be some societal level of playing field where we as society can agree at least these rules should be in place. And for farm animals, we feel at least the rules should be in place that animals aren't in cages. From there, let consumers choose. Hey, if I want cage-free or free-range or organic or vegetarian-fed or go to my local farmer's market, there's a million other choices out there. But at least there should be a baseline in society that reflects our morals that animals should at least not be caged. I will bring this point up. Michael, though?
Will somebody please make a rule for us people like that we shouldn't be in cages either? That would be. But go ahead, make your point. Make your point
on that issue. So what I would say is that we talked about mother pigs earlier being confined in these cages. Do you know how many pork products in this country are labeled that they're coming from operations that confine mother pigs in cages? Zero. So even if someone who cares, and you're right, I think most people care. So if most people care and they go to the grocery store and look at the pork section, how are they supposed to know if any of that pork came from operations that confine mother pigs in cages? They can't know because none of it's even labeled that it does. Yeah. That's why I firmly believe working with food companies to enact these policies, they can do the job for the consumers. This doesn't have to be like a Whole Foods thing. You brought up farmers markets. I'm a big fan of farmers markets, but it doesn't have to be farmers markets either. McDonald's we work with to announce they're going 100% cage-free. They buy 2 billion eggs a year. We work with places like IHOP and Denny's and Kroger and as many mainstream places that we can count. They've adopted policies that they're going to phase in over time the exclusive use of cage-free eggs, as an example.
And, of course, you're making tremendous inroads into that whole world of industrial agriculture as well. There's no doubt about that. But there's one final point I wanted to get to that you're working on that kind of has me scratching my head, and that is you're working on encouraging the government to find ways to get the world to eat cultivated and plant-based meats. Now, whenever I talk to my good friends who are vegan or vegetarian or something, I always kid them and say, you know, by not eating meat, you're depriving an animal of life. They will never get to experience life if you don't eat them. And I kind of think that's true. For example, we could let the animals run free like they do in India. You see cows running about the street, but if we don't eat animals, are we not depriving them of the opportunity to experience life?
Yeah, a few points on that. One is that the way most animals are raised for food, I'm not sure that anyone would look at these animals as having a life. I mean, are we depriving the life of a pig who would otherwise be confined in a cage where she never can turn around her whole life? Like, is that something, a good thing? Is it a good thing to confine a chicken in the meat industry who's genetically manipulated to grow so big so fast? They're killed at 45 days and are in a constant state of suffering throughout those weeks.
It's a fun philosophical question to bow out of the program because we're just about out of time. But I'd like you, if possible, to give some way people can get in touch with you, Humane Society of the United States, and the work that you're doing.
Well, folks can follow me on Twitter, Josh Balk, that's J-O-S-H-B-A-L-K. And folks can go to our Humane Society website. It's easy. It's humanesociety.org. We'd love to have you. And thanks for having me on the show, Michael. I appreciate it.
Josh Balk, it's so much fun. Thank you so much for putting up with my obnoxious questions. I really appreciate it. And folks, remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you, Michael. It was a pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.